Welcome again. Before we start, a couple trivialities. First, it's my first time ever teaching anything. So in case I go either too fast or secretly assume that you know something which you don't, really do let me know. And also, if I ever use phrases like obviously or it's easy to see that, just throw your pen at me, right? So, okay. And by the way, so this is a condensed matter core course. Because of time limitation and the fact that most of you guys probably won't end up being condensed matter physicists, this is not going to be a standard solid state class. So there will be a lot of bread and butter stuff for solid state physicists that I'm not going to cover. So if you want to continue and seriously do condensed matter physics, pick them up on your own or take another class. Okay, so let's begin. So what do we care about in condensed matter physics? Well, we care about many body systems, right? What we're really doing are many body physics. So, and for this class, mostly I'll be doing quantum many body physics. Things like electrons in a piece of solid. And this is an intrinsically hard problem. The thing is, we're talking about this many number of electrons. It's a quantum mechanical system. So at the end of the day, it becomes just a matrix organization. But it's a ridiculously large matrix. The dimension of the Hilbert space, right? So the number of numbers you need to specify even just a single eigenstate is exponential in that system size, right? Just take the simplest kind of electron, right? Forget about its location, just look at spin. So you have spin up and spin down. Then the dimension of the Hilbert space is something like that. It's a hopeless number. Okay. Actually, that number poses two difficulties. One difficulty is a practical one. We don't have a computer that's powerful enough to solve this kind of problem, right? I think the current state of the art numerical diagonalization can handle something like of order 20 electrons. Right? Obviously, that's not ideal. And it grows exponentially. So it's getting harder and harder to actually go to to handle more more electrons. Right? So the first, you have a computation issue. But there's a second problem with this, which is more conceptual. That is, suppose I give you a gigantic quantum computer, let's say in 50 years from now, who knows, so that you can actually diagonize this matrix. Okay? So you can compute all properties of any given material. Let's say you can predict drugs, you can calculate conductivity of any metal. That's great. But that poses another problem. That is, you don't feel you've understood anything. Seriously, right? You put a Hamiltonian, which is a matrix of this size, into your Hamiltonian, into your computer, it spits out to you a vector of this dimension. Right? It's this many numbers that you're looking at. So what do you mean by you've understood anything, right? So the second problem is, what is understanding? So to tackle both problems, the physicist approach is, essentially to cook up all sorts of spherical chickens in the vacuum, right? Some possibly oversimplified but understandable models, right? So this course will basically be talking about several, common but powerful spherical chickens that's used to tackle this kind of problem. And one justification for using the spherical chicken is that very often they work unreasonably well. And you think, okay, that you have some crazy assumptions behind, but somehow they work. And that's another thing I want to emphasize to you. That's universality. So we're going to talk about spherical chickens. Okay. And the reason they work is because of an idea called universality, which you probably have learned a little bit from your statistical mechanics class. That is, you can start from something simple, but the idea is even if you deform it slightly away, sometimes significantly away, the qualitative features don't really change. So you really know what you're doing. So for this class, I won't care too much, if at all, about mathematical rigor, but I will care a lot about universality. Right? So every time I show you some feature from some simplified model, you should always ask, how much does those feature depend on the nature of the spherical chicken? Right? If the spherical chicken is ever going to be useful, the statement I make better be unchanged if I deform the sphere a little bit, let's say I make an ellipse or something. All right, so that's so much about philosophy. Let's get in some concrete stuff. So the first set of spherical chickens I want to talk about, for at least a week, depending on how you go, maybe slightly longer, are theory of free electrons. And the notion of band theory, which is a very powerful tool. And what this band theory talks about is basically just free electrons on the lattice. So let me just, to be simple, make a one-dimensional case. Let's think about, the simplest thing, one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. Suppose I have some Hamiltonian in one dimension, and I want to solve a Schrodinger equation like this. And you can think of it as your standard kinetic term, g squared over 2m, plus a potential term. But the feature of this potential term is that it's periodic. It's something like, I want to think about a potential like this, which is what you have in a crystalline solid. Okay, let's say this distance is a. So what does the solution look like? What do we expect? Well, for any system, for any problem, it's always when you are handed with a problem, it's always to ask what are the symmetries. How can I leverage the symmetry to simplify the problem and even sometimes actually solve the problem? So what is a symmetry here? Right. So obviously, if I translate everything by integer times a, nothing's going to change. Right. So that's the discrete lattice translation. So it's a symmetry. Well, the lattice translation operator, as an operator, it works this way. So we call it T and A. So it means a translation by N, which is an integer, times A. Okay. So if I act that on, let's say, a convenient basis, basis, which is this position vector, the statement is this becomes x plus n a, okay, which is true for any x. So that's how I define our translation operator, and it's easy to see that. You can see that the Hamiltonian is going to be invariant under this because the potential is periodic. So the statement that it's a symmetry means that the action of this operator on the Hamiltonian, which this is the definition of what I mean here, gives back the Hamiltonian itself. Okay. Or in another word, translation and Hamiltonian commute. Right, so you can rewrite this part into here as T and A. And then it's more obvious. Right? So So it's an operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay. Moreover, this T operator is unitary. Unitary just means it preserves the norm, right? X goes to X, not X goes to something like 1/2 X or something, right? And you've done group theory, right? That's a quick check. So you presumably know that the symmetry that acts on a quantum mechanical system should always be unitary or anti-unitary, and in this case, it's unitary. So the unitarity of this symmetry operator, together with the fact that it commutes with the Hamiltonian, tells you that it can be simultaneously diagonizable. It's simultaneously diagonizable with the Hamiltonian. So any eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, I can label that also in terms of eigenvalues of this T. Okay. So, which means the translation acting on any eigenstate should give me some number, which is an eigenvalue, times the state itself. Like, at least I can always pick a basis so that it's true. Also, the fact that it's unitary, so it's norm preserving, means that this thing has to have amplitude 1. Can't have something like 1/2 or something. So the only thing it can be is a phase factor. So let me call this, define a number k. So to write this factor as e to the I ka, okay, for some k. And because only the phase factor is defined, so k actually doesn't take value in arbitrary real number, what happened is ka should take value in between 0 and 2 pi. Okay, so this really lives on a circle. Okay. So that's already, it's very tempting to say this is the momentum. In fact, this will be defined, will be called lattice momentum. It's different from the continuum moment, the usual momentum you talk about. There, the momentum lives is defined on the entire real axis and take arbitrarily high value. But here, it's defined on a circle. And that's because you have the periodic lattice, so your translation symmetry is reduced from the free space of essentially R to this discrete Z structure. By the way, the symmetry group is Z, if you because n takes any integer and it's abelian group. Okay. And if I have a finite system, but on a periodic boundary condition, then I can still talk about translation symmetry. It's just if I translate, if the system size is n, then I know that if I translate by n a, which by the way is ta to the raised to the power n, that's the group structure, then this should be 1. Should be identity because I'm just traveling through the entire circle. Okay, so if you put this into here, then you see that k is given by 2 pi n over n for n integer. Okay, but this is actually normal. This you have this even if I have a continuum free space, but on living on a circle, right? So momentum is quantized if I have a finite system. So for finite system, both this and this are true. Okay. So let me divide everything by A here, and let me call this G, which will be called reciprocal vector. Yes.
Sorry, you didn't get the formula Pn to the power n.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah. So, right. So this gives you an eigenvalue e to the I k a, and raised to the power n gives you this. I want this to be 1. So this better be an integer times 2 pi. Yeah.
Sorry, should we have the A dependence in the K?
Oh, yeah. mean, yeah. So at some point I'll start to write A equal to 1, but let's keep it for now. All right, so, and then once you know this, you can essentially rewrite this wave function, let me label it by k, as this. So this is literally a rewriting. Not doing introducing anything physically new here. I'm just extracting a phase factor out of the wave function. But this, combined with the fact that translation only gives you this phase factor, means that uk is actually periodic. Meaning, let's say if I take, okay, the more precise notion is the wave function of this uk, this inner product with the position space. This thing doesn't change if I just shift the position by integer times the lattice constant. Okay? So in some sense, this means that this uk is defined, can be defined uniquely just over one unit cell. So by unit cell, I mean a segment of this lattice, which is with length a, with which you can just translate by integer time multiplications and then fill the entire space. Okay? So just within this length L, you can define that U and then trivially reproduce it on all the other unit cells. And then you get this wave function. Okay? So this statement is known as Bloch theorem. Okay, and this uk sometimes is also known as the Bloch wave function or Bloch state, Bloch wave function. Okay. All right, so now let me give you some examples of how that actually works. Is there a question? Okay, yeah. Example one is called tight binding model. So by the way, the power of this statement is that the only information I put in is the fact that the Hamiltonian is periodic. I didn't even bother to write down an actual Hamiltonian for you. That's the beauty of it. You don't need to. But you can certainly plug in any Hamiltonian that satisfies this and see what happens. So let me talk about a tight binding model, which is imagine a bunch of atoms and electrons mostly bound on this on the atomic side, but then from time to time they can tunnel and hop around. So it's a one-dimensional lattice. Let me label the sides by an integer index I. And then, okay. So let me assume that there is a one electron orbit, or a state, if you like, per site. So let me call that state I. So by this state I just literally mean that electron sitting on site I. So it's that simple. And now let me write down a Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian looks like this. Yes.
Can you grab a bit larger, a bit bigger?
Oh, it's too small? Sorry. Yeah. Like this? Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not very much.
All right. Sorry. Can you see the Hamiltonian? Okay. Okay. So this Hamiltonian is saying that I have an amplitude T that can take an electron from the site I to site I plus one. Of course, to make a Hermitian, I want to have the Hermitian conjugate of that, so from I plus one to I. So just take that Hamiltonian. It's probably the simplest problem in band theory you can ever try to solve. So let's try to solve this. Let's just diagonalize a matrix here. And Bloch theorem told us already how to solve this. Essentially, you look for some momentum eigens. So you define K state as essentially a Fourier transform. I assume you won't confuse this I with this I hat. This I hat is the lattice site label. Okay. Suppose I have capital N total number of sites. Okay. So this is my Bloch state. And of course, I can do the inverse Fourier transform. You can play around with it yourself if you like. So assume I have total number of N sites, then momentum is, as I said, equal to 2 pi n, little n over capital N. I'm setting little a equal to 1 here. Okay? And let's take n from 0 to capital N minus 1, so that this little k runs from 0 to 2 pi. Okay? And then the Fourier, the inverse Fourier transform looks like this. Now just plug this into here. Okay, this is your first ever band structure problem. So let me do it actually in detail here. What you get is something like this. Plus the Hermitian conjugate. Okay. It's literally plugging this into this and that, right? And this part gives you a k. This part gives you a k prime. Okay. So you get this a sum like this, and then you stare at this sum. You realize that now this state and cats only depend on k and k prime. There's no dependence on I. The only dependence on I comes from here in this space factor. So now if you want to sum over I hat, it's pretty simple. It's literally just sum over this phase factor, which vanishes unless k prime minus k is 0, multiply. So the summation of this I hat, this thing, divide by n, this is equal to delta k k prime. That's just a You may have seen this in standard Fourier analysis. And then the summation over I hat is gone. The summation over K prime is gone because you are forced to identify that with K. So what you end up having is minus T e to the I K plus e to the minus I K K. So this part comes from here. This part comes from the Hermitian conjugate effect. Okay. And you know this thing, which is cosine 2k. Sorry, cosine k. Yes.
Silly question. The e to the I k prime. Where's
yeah.
that phase coming from? I got slightly lost.
Oh yeah. Sorry. There's an I here. So for k, you get k times I hat. That's an I plus 1,
yeah.
And then, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, if you're confused about algebraic details like this, feel free to raise your hand. Yeah.
What are these k states? And what are these k states?
What are these k states? These are going to be the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, which I eventually care about. Right? Of course, you mean this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So think of them as a plain weight. Right. So the statement is that the Bloch theorem guarantees that some kind of plane wave-ish state like this will solve your Hamiltonian, will diagonize your Hamiltonian. So then you just write down an ansatz like this and plug it in, see if it solves your problem. And in this case, it does. And Bloch theorem guarantees that you will always do.
Is there a difference between the I-hat and I states?
Yeah, sorry, I wrote I had just for a silly reason. I just don't want you to confuse that with this I, but you know, they are the same. Yeah, maybe I should use another symbol. All right. So so what does this look like? Well, essentially, I'm saying that I have states labeled by a number k, which runs from 0 to 2 pi, or equivalently, you can say it runs from minus pi to pi. It doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day, only the phase factor matters. And then I have a dispersion relation if I look at ek. Sorry, let me say this is, let me call this ek. Right. So the statement is k is actually an eigenvector of my Hamiltonian with the eigenenergy, the energy Ek, which is basically cosine k. Okay, and the dispersion looks like this. Okay. And if you actually focus on the k near zero part, this looks like a quadratic dispersion, right? Near k equal to zero, this part looks like, you know, cosine k expand around k equal to zero. It's a constant plus something like 1/2, and then you get something like t times k squared, which looks like a free space Schrodinger equation. That's what that's the type of dispersion you get. And that's also reasonable because if k is near zero, which means the state is varying very slowly in space. So the fact that I have a lattice at some tiny scale no longer matters. It looks essentially like a free space. So I should expect something like k square dispersion to happen. Okay, so that's your first band problem. Any question? Okay. Now let me talk about a second example. It's almost free electron. Well, not. Okay, these are free electrons, but almost free space. So this is a regime, if you want, like the lattice potential is very strong. The weaker part is when the electrons can, you know, tunnel occasionally a little bit from one side to the other. But let's talk about the opposite case. The opposite case is when I actually have a continuum Schrodinger equation. Okay. And I have an actual potential that's periodic, which also means that it's expandable in some Fourier component. Let me also neglect the n equal to zero part. Okay, the n equal to zero part is a constant. I can always shift it away. Okay, so just to make the make life easier, let's suppose or the potential strength is much smaller than the typical kinetic energy. But OK, the question is, what do I put p here? P is the inverse of a typical scale. What's the typical scale? A. Okay, so which means I want something like this. Okay, so suppose that's true. Right? And then you can try to use perturbation theory. See what happens. Right? So you take this part as your unperturbed Hamiltonian, and treat this as perturbation. Let's see what happens. Right. Originally, for the H0, you have the standard quadratic dispersion, p squared over. So let's say this is your p. Now you introduce this perturbation. What does it do? Well, These are plane wave states. These are e to the I kx like stuff. This is something like cosine 2 pi n over a times x. So this state takes you from k, right, if I expand this, over a x plus e to the minus I 2 pi n over a x. Right. So it looks like this. So this means that it boosts your momentum by plus or minus 2 pi n over a. So if I think about perturbation theory, if I take a random state here, that Hamiltonian will take me from this state to a state, for example, like here. Right? But in perturbation theory, this effect will be very weak since everything is divided by the difference in energy. Right? So you change it a little bit, but you don't actually do much. Yeah, you may change the shape of this from like this to something like that, but nothing really happens. Unless you're sitting at this pi over a or minus pi over a place, where you go from here to here, the original energy is the same. Right? So you can no longer use non-degenerate perturbation theory. You have to use degenerate perturbation theory because if you essentially 1 over delta E is infinite. Right. So what do you do? Well, so there's a trick that is, suppose I focus on momentum near this plus minus pi over a. Okay. So now consider a momentum eigenstate that's plus minus pi over a plus a delta p. And of course, I want delta p to be much smaller than pi over a. Just consider states like that and see what it looks like. Well, first of all, the h0 part, the kinetic part, that you can just expand. So that equal to a constant, which is this thing. It's just 1 over 2m. G0 square, which is a constant. It's not going to be important. Plus minus pi over 2ma delta p. This is just expand this to first order. Okay. But what does this part do, right? Let's say the scattering between these two momentum, the momentum change is 2 pi over a. So it only involves the v1. Component of this. So what you will see is that there's a matrix element introduced by the potential term between the plus and minus pi over a term. Okay. Remember, these two states differ by momentum to pi over a, so it's going to be scattered by this. And if you put in the state, it's going to be something like 1 half v1. V1 is the 2 pi over a part. The 1 half comes from the fact that cosine is this. And likewise, if I do the inverse one, right, it's the same. Okay. So now take these two states, plus minus pi over a plus the same delta p, and look at what the Hamiltonian looks like in this two state Hilbert space. Okay. The Hamiltonian will basically look like a constant plus this number, pi over 2m a p minus pi over 2m a delta p, 1 right. This is just this part with the plus sign. This one is the minus sign. And the off diagonal ones are this. Now you just diagonalize this Hamiltonian. Well, what does it look like? Well, it looks like pi over 2ma delta p sigma z, the Pauli matrix, plus 1 half v1 sigma x, the x Pauli matrix.
It's just a factor 2. I was thinking the factor 2 should cancel out the we have a square in H0. We have the square of square of pi over a plus delta. So the linear term will be 2.
Oh yeah. I think I. Yeah, I think you're right. Sorry. Yeah. Right. So now this Hamiltonian you can diagonalize. The answer is that it's a two-state Hamiltonian. So you're gonna have two eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are gonna be plus minus pi over ma square delta p square plus v1 square over. Let me just write this as v1 over square. What does that mean? Right? It means that this thing went from this to this. So now there is a gap opened here, right? Because as delta p goes to zero, there's still a difference in energy of order v between the positive and negative eigenvalue. So you no longer have this continuous line that goes all the way. You have this tiny gap. Okay. Everywhere else, you don't have to do that because of the energy difference in H0. So non-degenerate provision theory works. You only change some number. But this one is a qualitative change.
Sorry, can you say more about this energy gap? Does it have dependence on delta p?
No, it's literally just the gap that happens here. So the gap is what happens when you take delta p to zero. Yes.
So let's say in the tie binding model, we take the lattice spacing to go to zero, very small, and we take the continuous limit. Can we make these two agree, and how?
Yes. That is actually the next thing I'm going to talk about. But before I go there, let me just say briefly one thing I need to say. So okay, let me redraw that thing because I'm drawing it terribly. So so that's just the reasoning at this set of momentum. But it works at any m pi over a, right? For any m pi over a, you can find some scattering that takes you to another degenerate state. So what will end up happening is that the original dispersion becomes something like this. So this is at pi minus pi over a, this is at pi over a. Then you have another funny thing happening at 2 pi over a, or minus 2 pi over a. So there's another gap that's opened, like this. And it goes on. For any integer times pi over a, you have something like that. You have a gap open. And another thing is because of the mix, remember, there is now an off-diagonal element between plus pi over a and minus pi over a, which means momentum is actually no longer conserved. We're talking about hybridized states between plus and minus pi over a momentum. So momentum is only conserved up to 2 pi over a, which is saying I should really just label the state by momentum mod 2 pi over a, which is nothing but my crystal momentum. Okay? And the trick to do that is to say that now I no longer draw it this way. Let me shift this curve a little bit to here. And shift this curve a little bit to here. Right? And then this curve I can always shift it by integer times 2 pi over a, and you'll see that it goes to, I think it goes to here. And this one I shift by 2 pi over, or minus 2 pi over a becomes like this. So if I only focus on momentum defined mod 2 pi over a, then forget about this thing. Just look at this shit. This is the actual, this is the thing that people call band structure, okay? At least in terms of dispersion. Okay? And each of this thing, you know, this is called a band. Okay, so this is a band, this is band, this is another band. Okay. So, but I want to go back to the Bloch theorem, saying that, you know, my Bloch wave function at the band index, this little n now denotes the band index 1, 2, 3, and so on. So at each momentum, this is basically e to the I kx. But if it's just free space, then that's it, right? In some that means a trivial Bloch wave function. But in general, I expect something like this. Yes.
All right, where did the up middle?
Yeah. So sorry. This thing, you should think of shifting the momentum by some integer number of 2 pi over a.
Okay.
And the convenient thing, you don't have to, but it's convenient to shift it to this region, because you can always write k between this region.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of choice. You can write k in this region. Doesn't really matter, as long as it's defined mod 2 pi over a. Right. So this thing, if you shift by, let's say, minus 2 pi over a, you shift to like this. And this part, it goes like this. And the periodicity guarantees that this thing will match. So here, they will have the same energy. This energy will be the same as this energy, because you know, this is really a circle. So this momentum should be eventually identified when you write in terms of crystal lattice momentum. Right. So, yes.
We'll have independent. Why do we have hex dependence in the right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So in general, as I said, momentum is only conserved up to 2 pi over a. In general, my eigenstate should look like this, where k is defined mod 2 pi over a, but if I start from an actual continuum free space, I expect this part to actually contain Fourier component in integer times 2 pi over a. Because that's what you expect from Bloch theorem. Because Bloch theorem says whatever that comes after this e to the I k over kx, it should be periodic if I shift little x by integer times a, which is true here, yes.
No, sorry, I don't understand the notation. So on the left-hand side, we have, for example, on the left-hand side, we have an n that doesn't appear on the right-hand side.
Yes. So the this amplitudes will depend on n in general. Sorry, n is the band. For example, if I only look at, I want to look at this state, for example, then it means n equal to 1. Right. So in general, this state and this state, even though they are at the same crystal momentum, means this part is the same. But this part don't have to. In fact, it should be orthogonal. Right? So this amplitude UL will depend on the banding.
So in terms of Bloch theorem, the Bloch wave function is what's after the summation?
Yes.
And then we get the factor of each there.
Yes. So this will be your UK. Of course, there's a band index. Right? So, and now there's this statement that is, even though it's presented in a very different way, you end up having something quite similar. Right? Here, you end up with this. here you end up with this, while you have multiple bands, but otherwise they look more or less the same. There is an important statement that I won't actually prove for you, is that these two examples are more or less the same. If I introduce a cutoff, an energy cutoff, energy, gamma, in example two. Meaning is that I decide an energy, could be high, let's say here, above which I don't care about the states anymore. That's reasonable. We're mostly dealing with temperature that are not high, not that high. Well, even if we do, there's always even a higher energy that we don't care. Right. So if I introduce such a cutoff and throw away all the high energy modes, I end up with this kind of thing. Right, just a finite number of bands. And there is a statement that's mostly true, and it gets really interesting when it's not true. That is, this kind of finite number of energy bands can always be reproduced by a appropriate choice of the type binding model. Okay? So suppose I take my cutoff here so that I'm literally left with just one band. Then it's reproducible just by something like this. Right? Maybe not exactly this. Maybe I need to introduce some more complicated term, like second neighbor hopping, things like I plus two, or something like that. Right? But it's reproducible. Okay. And that kind of type binding orbits that mimic this kind of continuum bands, they have a name, they're known as one-year orbitals. But let me not get into the actual details. Yes?
The idea is to modify the type binding model to have more than one electron per side?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So you can have, for example, I with an additional orbital index n.
All right.
For example.
Okay.
What's the physical meaning of this the similar between these two examples?
There are two ways to say it. One way is this kind of band structure. Let's say I have some dispersion, I have some structure I want to reproduce. Well, in this case, it's mostly dispersion, but there are more complicated cases where I want to reproduce other things as well. But with this, I probably can't, right? Because I just get it cosine k. Right? That thing won't look like cosine k for most of the part. But I can add other stuff like this kind of term or certain neighbor hopping and so on. Right? I still want to keep locality. That's important. I don't want to, let's say, this I to kind of hop arbitrarily far away with order one amplitude. I want essentially I want this kind of amplitude, let's say. If this is some integer, let's say L, I want TL to decay reasonably fast as L goes larger. There are requirements like that. But the statement is there's some way of making this band structure that can mimic that kind of band structure, continuum ones. And to some extent, that's almost a trivial statement. Because it's literally an inverse Fourier transform. Right? If I'm having a finite number of such bands defined with momentum on a circle, I can always do an inverse Fourier transform to make everything defined on an integer lattice. Right? There's no problem with that. The subtlety is when you do that, how do you know that the time binding model you end up with are actually local? They actually have nice property like this. Right? That's a more non-trivial thing. Very often it's doable, but becomes undoable when the band structure has some non-trivial topology. It actually becomes a question of whether you can trivialize some U1 fiber bonds or something. But let me not go into those things. I will actually come back briefly, maybe lecture 4 or something.
You can trivialize what, sorry?
A U1 bundle.
Okay, nice.
Yes. If you're nerdy enough, a band is actually a U1 bundle. But But let's not do that. All right, so by the way, is this pace too fast or too slow or anything? Anyone think it's too slow?
I think it's too fast.
Okay, so one last thing. So why do I emphasize this? Because time binding models are usually much nicer to work with. For one reason is that they have finite Hilbert space dimension per unit volume. Right? This thing doesn't. This thing goes on forever. Right? And anything finite is always better defined when you think about more complicated problems like interacting electrons and so on. That's why people prefer to work with those things. Even conceptually, it's easier to think about. So finite per volume. Right. That's somehow we always prefer that whenever possible. Okay, that's problem of literally one electron. I haven't talked about anything beyond that. So now let's move on to the problem with many electrons. But let's be simple. Let's say I have many electrons, but they don't talk to each other. They don't interact. Right, let's turn off the interaction. So non-interacting. So sometimes we also say that's free. Okay. Except they have Pauli exclusion principle and the standard thing that fermions do. Right. So how do I write down the theory? Well, I want let's go to the time binding representation. Right? Instead of having I and ket I or bra I, let me introduce the fermion creation annihilation operator. Let's again do the one orbital problem, right? Just one fermion orbital per site. So let me just make sure. Do you guys know what these things are? Is it covered in some way in quantum mechanics class? Yeah, okay, good. So it's a very brief reminder on different sites, they anti-commute. But on the same site, there's a non-trivial commutation, anti-commutation between C and C dagger. Yeah, that's all you need to do. So now I can write my Hamiltonian. That's literally the same time-binding Hamiltonian, but in the second quantized language as Ci plus one. Let me drop the hat. It doesn't. Let me also write a chemical potential term. Sometimes you can, people absorb chemical potential term into the Hamiltonian. Sometimes you keep it as an external thing. It doesn't really matter for our purpose. Okay. So this is like the energy it takes for you to have an orbit filled. So now you can do the same trick of doing Fourier transform. The only difference is you replace all the kets by Cs. Right? So you can now define Ck as, I think, 1 over square root n, sum over I, I k I. You know what I'm doing.
Sorry. Yes. That's the self energy, right? We didn't add that.
This one?
Yeah.
You don't call that self energy. You call that chemical potential.
Okay. Do we need that?
We didn't have that before because we were doing single particle physics. So it's a it's a constant, it's an identity matrix. Yeah. It doesn't really do anything. We will do soon. We'll need this soon.
Okay.
Think of it as a chemical potential. It tells you how many electrons are going to be there. Right, you just define the momentum eigenstate creation operator this way. You do the inverse Fourier transform, plug it in. You see that this gives you exactly what you had before. K cosine K CK CK. And because this is an identity, this part is also the same. So let me actually shift this one to cosine K. CK. Right? So what does the ground state look like? Well, the statement is, let me call this thing CK. Or for ground state, just like the free Fermi gas, actually, I expect the mode to be filled if C, if the energy, or energy minus chemical potential, doesn't matter how you define it, is smaller than zero and empty if this is larger than zero. Right. Again, if you want to talk about finite temperature, you can do your standard Stemmeck, and instead of one and zero, you get a distribution. So in terms of figure, that looks like this. Minus pi over a, pi over a. So let's say you have a. So this is your cosine k, but shifted by constant. So in general, it looks like something like this, right? So there are essentially two scenarios. One is this, where there are still some states with this energy or energy minus mu below zero. So you're supposed to fill them. But then you leave everything else empty. So this is pretty much like a Fermi surface. Right. They behave in many ways like the Fermi gas you learned probably in Stemmeck or something. Right? So that's scenario one, or scenario A. But scenario B is a much more boring scenario. That's when either this or this happens. In this scenario, you have everything filled. So your ground state is pretty boring. And this state, again, everything is empty. So there's nothing there. Right? If you think about electromagnetic property, right, for example, you try to kick this system a little bit, let's say shoot a small electric field or something, this thing is not going to do anything, right? Because essentially you have only one state there. But this one, for example, you can take a particle from here to here, right? It's a different state. It has a slightly higher energy, but only slightly. It vanishes as 1 over L or something, or 1 over N. So this state has a lot of life. It's a metal. And if I want to create an excitation, there's no gap. Right? Well, this state has a gap. Yes?
Sorry, I don't see why it is going to be Bill and
not Bill. Oh. Sorry, the rule is this, right? So by ground state, I mean everything with C less than zero is filled. Everything with C larger than zero is empty. So I'm plotting C, right? Or equally, I can plot E, this 2t cosine, and then I can draw, that will look like this. That will look like this. But then I can say, I can put my chemical potential, let's say, here, and then say all the energy less than chemical potential, they should be filled, all the energy higher than chemical potential should be.
So is this the very idea of, like, one can see this as like the Dirac-C? Like?
Basically. Yeah. So this filled part of the of you know of fermions, they are known as Fermi Dirac C, or not, more like Fermi C. Dirac C will be something slightly different, but we'll get there at some point.
Is that a definition, or do you get that from some condition from 2D Bosque? The ground state.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Oh.
Can you like derive it from?
Yes. So, well, you can either do the standard Stamac, in which case you will see that, because you know if you do Stamac, it tells you the expectation of any energy level for a free fermion is something like 1 over e to the energy over t. I'm setting kb equal to 1, plus 1, right? And as t goes to 0, you see that it goes behaves like that. Right? That's one way to say it. The other way is to say you literally treat this as a Hamiltonian, right? And then you ask, what is the possible lowest energy you can ever have, right? Well, for one thing, if, so let me rewrite this. Ck. For one thing, if this is negative, you want to take advantage of that to lower your energy by occupying the state, by having this equal to 1. And then your energy will be the sum of a bunch of negative numbers, which is always getting lower and lower. But if it's positive, you better avoid that, because that raises your energy. Right, so that's another way to see it. Yeah.
This Hamiltonian doesn't have a conserved particle number?
It does. This is actually, this is your conserved particle. Okay. This commutes with Hamiltonian. Yes.
Yeah. But like when we say that the ground state is like all the negative energy states are filled, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That depends on mu. So in some
yes.
sense, like mu is determined by the number of particles.
Yes.
That we have.
Yes. Yes. So yes. So open a Stamac book, it tells you that there are different rules you can play with. You can fix particle number, or you can fix chemical potential. For most purposes, it doesn't really matter as long as you do it consistently. But there are some subtle cases. For this kind of thing, it's usually more convenient to fix chemical. Okay, so so what's the lesson? The lesson is to have insulator. Well, you want to completely fill a band or an integer number of bands. It doesn't really matter, right? If you have some more bands here, this doesn't matter, right? But it's going to be an integer, which means the charge density or the particle filling per unit cell has to be an integer. Otherwise, you can't possibly have something like this. Right? So if you have some fractional charge density, then you know that you, at least within free electron band theory, you can't have anything like insulator. That alone is already a powerful state.
No, I don't understand.
Yes, sorry?
What's charge density? What's that?
So remember, this is the density of the, or occupation number of an electron. The statement is, on average, since I have translation symmetry, this is not going to depend on I. So the statement is, this number better be an integer if I want to fill integer number of bands.
What is the relationship of that with the Fourier transforms, the k's, the ck's?
Oh yeah, this is going to be, well, essentially sum over k over n. If you do the Fourier transform. So if I have a band completely filled, then this is 1 for all k, and then I get 1.
So that's saying that, yeah, that.
On the other hand, if I have a partially filled, then some of this will be 1, some of this will be 0. When I divide by n, it's going to be some, I don't know, fractional number.
Mm-hmm.
But that means I have this scenario. Of course, I lied you to a little bit because the real life electrons have spin. So far, I haven't even mentioned the word of spin. But that, in most cases, it doesn't really hurt because spin up and spin down mostly don't talk to each other, especially if I have some kind of spin rotation symmetry. Then what happens is for insulator, I expect the charge density per unit volume to be an even integer. Essentially, I have to do the same thing for spin up and spin down. That's it. Okay. And most real life insulators do satisfy this. We have an insulator that doesn't satisfy this rule. That's extremely interesting. And and by the way, when you have an insulator, but with a small gap between a filled and unfilled band, some terminology. So a filled band is called a valence band, and an unfilled band, empty band, is called a conduction band. That's a terminology from semiconductor physics. And there's really a semiconductor means an insulator with a gap between the filled and unfilled band that's not too large. In case you wonder where those terminology come from. Okay. All right, so last couple minutes, these are all in one dimension. These are just super toy models. But it's actually not that hard to extend to higher dimensions, right? So, because none of the things I talked about really depend on the fact that I'm doing one thing, except the notations are simpler. So let me quickly tell you what it looks like in higher D. Let me see. Yes?
It seems that the definition of insulator depends on the magnitude of the chemical potential mu.
Yes. So if you are allowed to tune chemical potential, then you can change an insulator to a metal. Yes, people do that. Great, so let's now do in arbitrary dimension. Let's see which part I want to erase. I think I don't need that part. So in higher dimension, the only difference is, you're in higher dimension. I mean, the definition of discrete translation symmetry is saying that, let's say, just to be concrete, let's say 3D. 2D will be very similar. Before we say translation by any integer times A is a symmetry. Now we just replace that by saying translation by anything like NA1 plus, let's say, let's say N1A1 and N2A2 plus N3A3 is a symmetry. Where A1, A123 are linearly independent. There are some vectors in real space. Right, that spans the for the vectors. And N123 are in integer. Okay. So previously the translation symmetry that forms an algebra of Z, the integers. Now it's just now it gives you a Z 3 copies of Z. Okay, and then all the statements I made goes through. Okay, what happened is that if I have a state, an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, I can again label it using the eigenvalues of this operator. And then again, all these translations commute, for example. You know, it doesn't matter if I first do A1 translation or A2 translation. So they commute. So they're all simultaneously diagonalizable. There's no issue with that. Then what happened is that under T translation, let's say by N1, N2, N3, let's label this N as a vector, right? By N vector, I mean N1, 2, 3. Again, I just write it as a phase factor. It's a unitary symmetry. And by the group structure, the phase factor looks like K1 and 1 plus K2 and 2 plus K3 and 3. Okay. The argument is exactly the same. But the only subtlety is this basis may be a weird basis. Okay? The nicest case is cubic, right? A1, A2, A3, they're X, Y, Z. Then, okay, it's pretty trivial. But there are sometimes they're linearly independent, but they're not exactly orthogonal. You have to take care of that. But that's just some technical subtlety that it's some geometry that's not too hard to work out. Okay? So let me call this K tilde, just so it's so I can also write it in a slightly different basis that looks more like conventional momentum. That's K, I think, K dot N A 1 plus N 2 A 2. Right, it's just a basis choice, really. Right. So in this choice, obviously, all the K tilde component still lives on a circle, standard circle, from 0 to 2 pi. Well, this, I have to be a little bit more careful.
So for his psi of B, the energy of the Hamiltonian, but that would only work if your Hamiltonian looks like a free Hamiltonian.
No, like, what?
What if it depends on a potential, that depends, like it's a potential that it's a function of your site in your lattice, whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. I want the Hamiltonian to be invariant under this discrete translation, right? So within, let's say, within some distance smaller than little a, they can do crazy stuff. It doesn't matter. But if I translate by integer multiple of a, the Hamiltonian has to come back to itself. That's the only requirement I'm putting in. Turns out that requirement dictates that, because it's a, essentially it's a z to the third symmetry, unitary, so it has to be the eigenstates has to form some kind of representation of this symmetry, and this group is so simple that the representation can't be too complicated. It has to be something like this. That's a one-line statement of Bohr theorem. Okay, so in this basis, it's this little k is more directly related to ordinary momentum we talk about. But of course, the range becomes a little bit more subtle. But you can work out the I'll just tell you the result. So if in the k hat, the k tilde basis, then k tilde, for example, the ith component is identified with ith component plus 2 pi. Right? But in the standard k representation, turns out it's identified if I shift things by something called a reciprocal lattice factor. So in the one-dimensional case, that g is nothing but the 2 pi over a I kept talking about, because they mix your momentum when they differ by 2 pi over a. And you have the 3D or whatever dimension analog of that, which is called the reciprocal vector. And some algebra, well, what do we want of this? Well, we want, for example, g hat for any, sorry, the g vector, when it dots with any integer, you know, combinations of this kind of thing, to be a multiple of pi, of 2 pi. Let's say m times 2 pi. For example, in the one-dimensional case, that's how we worked out. Right. That gives you g order 2 pi over l. Okay. So for three-dimensional, you just put in this requirement for arbitrary n1, n2, n3, and then see what happens. Then a few some algebra you can play around with yourself tells you that you have something like gi. For the case of three dimension, given by 2 pi epsilon ijk aj cross ak divide by some ijk ai dot aj cross ak. Of course, you can play this game in 2D as well. You get a very similar expression. Which we'll do later. Well, the thing is, in case you didn't notice, this object, let me not use n, let me use l. So integer combination of different g vector also defines a lattice. And k, by definition, lives in the unit cell of this lattice. And this lattice has a name that's called the reciprocal lattice. And a unit cell of this lattice also has a name, it's called the Brillouin zone. Let me see if I can spell it right. Or I'll just call BZ. Okay. And everything I said about, you know, insulators and metals go through. And again, if I have even integer number of particles per site, then I end up having integer number, then I can have integer number of bands filled, and that gives me an insulator. But if that number is fractional, I have to get a metal. And a metal there means a Fermi surface. Except the Fermi surface can, you know, they can look somewhat circular. For example, if, let's take the simplest Brillouin zone, let's take the square lattice. By the way, if little a, this A's, as I said, if they just form some orthogonal unit vector, then the whole thing is pretty simple. It's just a square. For example, if I have a little bit of filling, right, if rho is much less than 1, then the metal I get looks like something like this. So I have a little bit of states filled here. As long as I'm not, you know, I'm far away from this zone boundaries, right, just like the one-dimensional case where I can expand cosine k as k square, right? So this thing, again, I can expand in terms of some p square. So it really looks like the free Fermi gas you learned instead. Okay. But I can have some other case where the filling is large, well, less than 1, but reasonably large. It can become something like this, for example, where everything here are filled. That happens in some model, in some case. But then, you know, I can reorganize my Brillouin zone, because everything is defined only mod 2 pi, right? So I can essentially move this part to here, this part to here, and so on. And after some reshuffling, it's very similar to the kind of reshuffling I did here. Okay. I end up having a picture like this. So there's a circle out of which everything is filled, but within which it's empty. So this is known as a whole Fermi surface. Or Fermi pocket, or Fermi surface, or Fermi volume, doesn't matter. And the hole is as good as an electron because, as you know, when you talk about this thing, you can certainly redefine an object like this. You can switch the dagger and non-dagger. The algebra doesn't change. It's particle and hole. Yes?
Sorry, I have a question. So in the one-dimensional case, we explore like the whole range from minus pi over 8 to pi over 8 of our reciprocal lattice vector, which in this case was 1. Now, however, the Brillouin sum, the unit lattice, of course, in the square case, they coincide, but in the general case, the Brillouin sum is going to be different
yes.
from exploring minus pi over 8,
yes.
pi over 8
yes.
of the reciprocal lattice vector.
Yes.
Right? It's not going to be that simple. It's
yes.
going to be a much
yes.
more complicated
yes.
figure.
Yes.
So why do we write down... I don't see why what's important is the unit cell of the reciprocal lattice and not the span from minus pi over 8 to pi over 8.
Yeah. Definitely. So I'm just taking the simplest possible example there here to just illustrate the point that you have something that looks like whole pockets. Yeah. But in general, you're right. Right. In fact, next lecture will be I'll talk about a non-trivial Brillouin sum. But a metal typically looks something like this. Okay? So you may have slightly weirder Brillouin zone and so on, but in general, you have a Fermi surface. It doesn't have to be a connected, right? You can have pockets here and there and so on. So that depends on detail. Okay, so also let me just tell you the fact that in a typical metal, the Fermi energy is very high. So we're always at low energy limit. Let me first remind you what I mean by those words. So there are a bunch of quantities actually you can define. So you can define velocity of an electron, not in free space, but now moving on a crystal lattice. Right? So you can ask, well, what does that mean? Well, the velocity, the meaning is, or the definition is just that, the nth band. Okay. So the derivative of energy with respect to momentum. That's normally how you define velocity. Okay. So this thing is always defined. It is defined. Also, we can talk about effective mass, which, if you think about it, comes from a second derivative of energy with respect to momentum. So it's, in general, it has a formula of the inverse mass. It's easier to define. You take your most familiar k square over 2m. That's how you define mass. But of course, this expression means that A, it doesn't have to be a constant in the Brillouin zone. It can be a function of momentum. And B, you can have off diagonal terms. It doesn't have to be an identity matrix. But in general, it's symmetric because it's double derivative. Okay. So for example, if you have a Fermi surface like this, even though I'm on the lattice, I can still talk about effective mass, effective velocity, and so on. All those things are defined and will be important. And now we can talk about Fermi energy. And that one, OK, you can define it a couple ways. You can say it's the chemical potential. Well, the slightly better way is to say it's something of order kF times vF. K KF meaning the typical wavelength at the Fermi C, at the Fermi surface, this one, and times the velocity. So that's roughly the order of Fermi energy you want to talk about. And for the typical metal, that thing is pretty huge. It goes like 10 to the fourth or 10 to the fifth Kelvin. So room temperature is pretty cold for a typical metal. And that allows to actually analytically understand a large number of properties of metal, precisely because of this. All right, so any question at this point? Yes.
Question,
yes.
If we do the same as that example two, to our, for example, the 2D square lattice.
Yes.
For me, it's apparently not the same thing, because in 1D situation, we only consider the 2 points to share the same
yes.
energy.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean the dispersion relation.
Yes.
So what should we do
yes.
in the case?
Good. Let me take a simple example, just to illustrate the point. Actually doing it, writing out all the indices may be a bit tedious, but let me just show you the idea. The idea is, suppose I have a Brillouin zone that's of this size. And suppose before I turn on my lattice potential, the free Hamiltonian has a ground state that's just a Fermi ball, Fermi surface, that looks like this. Right? No. Forget about Fermi surface. Now let me just do one body problem, because that entire issue is a one body problem. Yeah. So before I turn on my potential, it's a parabolic band, right? It's E is k squared. So after I turn on my chemical potential, what I have is a scattering across this kind of surface. So what I need to solve is that anytime I have two different momentum deferred by a reciprocal lattice vector, and they happen to have the same kinetic energy, which is p squared, then I have to do degenerate perturbation theory. Then what happens typically is a gap is open. Okay. So what will happen is, what will happen is that before the spectrum goes continuously upward, right, if you imagine this direction being the energy. But now it goes upward, but at the zone boundary, because of the G scattering, a gap gets opened. So it pretty much, if you make a one-dimensional cut, it pretty much still looks like that. Sorry, where is the figure I draw?
Covered up underneath there. Not the one.
Wait.
You covered up one of those boards over there. On the left.
On the left? Yeah. Okay, maybe I erased it. But if you make a one-dimensional cut, it's easier to draw. It's the same as before. Start from this. Well, except you don't start from zero. Let's say you cut from here. Then this is not at zero. But still, you get, whenever you are at these two momentum points, the gap gets opened up. For any cut. So what happened is you have a band that fills this square, and then all the original energy levels just beyond this square get a gap from this.
But generally, we don't need such a 1D cut on our.
Yeah, it's just easier for you to see. Yeah. I would like to draw an actual better plot, but just my capability of drawing. Essentially, all the original state that lives on the zone boundary, right, before it's continuously connected to the next level, to the next state. But now they have a gap. Okay. In general, you expect that. No, actually, sorry. No. Sorry, that's not entirely true. Oh yeah, it is true. Yeah. But square lattice is true. Because this point and this point, they have originally they have the same kinetic energy. So any time you have the same kinetic energy and then a scattering between the two levels, you expect it, yeah. All right, yeah, that's it for today. Yeah, tomorrow we do graphene. It's a slightly more interesting lattice.